Totally Football Show. Today, Man City, Pep side, break records sound like one as they sweep past another rival, while Chelsea down Man United. Spurs win again at Wembley, successfully evading Palace attacks. One of two such stories we've heard this weekend. And West Ham manager finally gets on the same page as their supporters by leaving early. We ask what next for the Hammers, salute Burnley Brighton and the power of seagulls, and catch up on action around the world. Plus, we look forward to the start of those Road to Russia playoffs this Thursday as Northern Ireland take on the Swiss. Can they make it to their first World Cup in 32 years? It is the Totally Football Show. And here's your panel today. We've got Daniel Storey in.
Lovely to be here.
FSF Football Columnist of the Year and published author.
Indeed, yes.
Your book is?
Portrait of an Icon.
We'll hear more about that later on, Daniel. Also here, Ian McIntosh.
Hi.
You've got a story about a seagull.
Oh, that's finally time to tell it.
Great. And Sasha Gurionov on the eve, Sasha, of the 100th anniversary of...
the Russian Revolution.
Excellent. Wow. Well, much to talk about today. I'm trying to think of a tie-in with West Ham and Hammer and Sickly. There we go with that. If it was Palace, you could have Palace Revolution, of course, but that is it. Because Bilic has gone and gone early. In fact, usually it's about 1 o'clock when everyone's finished recording their podcast. But the news has come in early, Sasha.
So well done, West Ham, for announcing it.
Yeah. You were at the game
yes,
Saturday afternoon.
Yes, they were shambolic. They were shambolic a year ago, they were shambolic 9 months ago, 6 months ago, and you know, I was surprised that he actually managed to make it into this year. But it always seemed to be about a game or two away from the sack, then they get a decent run of results and he stays. But against Liverpool, I mean, they set up as a 5-4-1, trying to deny the space, then they got caught on the corner, and to be honest, it was game over after that. He tried 4-4-2 second half and Liverpool just picked off the space.
Right, well, it's been in the mail for a long time, this. So, well, we'll talk more about what happened at the London Stadium and what's going to happen with the Hammers later on. But the big story, Daniel, if you'll excuse, was, of course, Man City. They are now 8 points clear after their win against Arsenal. That's a record after 11 games in the Premier League era. They've won 15 straight in all competitions. They have 31 points and their goal difference is plus 31. That's the best start to a Premier League season after 11 games. They basically swear at your TV good.
Yeah, they are running away with the Premier League, and we talked about title challenges at the start of the season, and the way it's looking, we're not going to get any.
I haven't been swearing at them. I've been rubbing my thighs and going, oh, that kind of good, in some of the passing manoeuvres. The goals they've scored, I think it's 38 goals now. There will be like five teams in this division who will not score over the course of this season how many Manchester City have scored on fireworks night.
Crazy.
That's how freely they're scoring.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Do you think Palace are going to score 38?
I'm saying Palace will probably be one of the five that won't.
Five?
Yeah. Oh. I think it's generally about five
or
six.
Who are you on the four then?
Swansea, seeing that they probably won't rack up even 38 shots in that time.
Man United?
But, yeah.
Possibly. Man City at the moment clearly far too good for the rest of the Premier League. Mark Carlisle asks, can you think of a composite European team to challenge Man City? English teams can't do it on their own. I like that. Are we at that point, Daniel, where the peoples of the earth have to kind of forget their differences and band together to defeat this?
I don't think we're not quite there yet. The only reason to even slightly doubt Manchester City is that they haven't played Manchester United or Tottenham yet. And last October, they lost to Spurs after their phenomenal league start, and it kind of derailed them for a few months, really. The caveat to that is that, yeah, they have beaten teams 4-9 by an aggregate, I think, of 21. So, yeah, there's more reasons for United and Spurs to be scared of them than they are of Spurs.
I was going to say, the flip side would be that United and Spurs haven't played Man City yet. This weekend, new ways to be impressed by Kevin De Bruyne?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that has impressed me this season is a slightly nerdy thing, but his use of his weaker foot in shooting positions. He scored the winner against Chelsea with his left foot, scored the opener against Arsenal with his weaker foot. And there doesn't even seem to be a delay in his... Everything seems to be natural for him. There doesn't seem to be even a thought process of, oh yeah, I might use my weaker foot here rather than trying to use my right as a normal, you know, a mortal footballer would. And everything he does is is almost exact. There was one pass in the second half when he was through on goal and should have played it across, I think, to Jesus to make it 4-1, and he didn't do it. And you could see the fans sort of gasp and go, that's not how Kevin De Bruyne is meant to play. But yeah, he's raised our expectations, and he's been by far the best player in the league this season.
Mm. Sasha, have you wanted to find, I don't know, twigs for other teams to cling on to? There's a little bit of sloppiness from Man City in the second half, and Arsene Wenger making a fairly spurious case for the penalty not being a penalty, but did he have a claim? Did he have a fair point about the offside on the third goal?
Yeah, offside was definitely offside, but it did. But City should have been 5-6-0 up by then, so it made absolutely no difference. I think perhaps the only thing that might derail City slightly is trying to accommodate Aguero, because they look better for me without Aguero. With Jesus up front, I mean, it's when Aguero got injured in that taxi when they played against Chelsea and won 1-0. For me, that was the most complete to date City performance under Guardiola, and I thought it was significant that Aguero wasn't there. When I was on the show a few weeks ago, Raphael Honigstein mentioned that perhaps Aguero was slightly hiding behind the work rate of Jesus. And here, against Chelsea and then against Stoke, there was nobody hiding behind the work rate of Jesus. They were all working. It was moving so naturally. So for me, perhaps you should play without Aguero.
The top scorer ever.
Exactly. I mean, it sounds absolutely absurd, but again, that Chelsea game impressed me so much because I thought I finally maybe got the point of what Pep was trying to do. And that total plan perhaps did not include Aguero.
I thought what they did off the ball was key to stopping Arsenal getting any kind of rhythm. You could see Petr Cech desperately trying to roll it out and play from the back. But there were three Man City players all over, closing down every passing lane. That put him in a position where he had to go long all the time with his goal kicks. He had to smash it over the halfway line. But there's no point doing that when you've got Alexis Sanchez, who's about as tall as Kylie, and Mesut Ozil, who's probably not going to challenge for a header.
Who's kind of like Jason a bit. that's an interesting question. Sasha proposing that Man City take the field without the Aguero fellow. Should Arsenal be taking the field with maybe Lacazette, who they splurged 50 million on this summer, rather than Sanchez?
Well, it's certainly an odd thing to spend the better part of 50 million quid on someone and not play him in your big games. Mm. And it's not the first time this season that's happened. Sanchez is still... I think he's putting in professional performances, but he's nowhere near the level that we know
he can. Were they better after Lacazette came?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but then they also benefited from the fact that City had kind of thought, right, we're 2-0 up against Arsenal, we're probably done for the day.
All right. And another controversial team selection, would they be better without Coquelin as a centre-half?
I mean, Wenger's argument was that it enabled them to continue playing three at the back, which they'd done for, you know, for a period of time, and it brought a sort of an air of continuity to the team. And on Thursday, he in the Europa League, he's played Mohamed Elneny as a centre back in the same way. But there has to be a case that if you are selecting Francis Coquelin as a centre back, it might be worth thinking about the change in formation rather than personnel.
Yeah, and Coquelin is the last person you want in the middle there with the ball under pressure with lots of options to choose from. He was just getting very flustered very early. I'm not sure how many transfer windows Arsene Wenger's had, but I'd imagine it's quite a few.
Mm. Indeed. Pep won the post-game too when he was told about Arsene Wenger's complaints about some of the refereeing. He said, "They tell me it was offside. I don't like to win in that way, but sometimes Arsenal win at Burnley in 96th minute with a hand, so sometimes it is like this." Arsenal have Spurs in a fortnight. Chelsea and Man United, will they have watched that game before they took the field, or would they have basically had a media blackout to focus on the game at Stamford Bridge?
I suspect they knew the result, and actually the way the first half panned out made it look as if both teams knew about the result, because we expected a kind of dour Manchester United Anfield performance, and what we got was a very open first half, as if to say Manchester City have gone 8 points clear an hour ago. If we're going to hang on those coattails, a draw's not really good enough.
Sasha, you and Daniel were both there. It was curious how a lot of people were expecting Mourinho to do a classic Mourinho away against a big side performance. And it's fair to say it wasn't. As Daniel was just saying, it was a much more open approach. But in which case, is this the first time of other people getting into Mourinho's head rather than vice versa?
Well, I think certainly Guardiola has been in Mourinho's head for the last number of years, rather than the other way around, in my opinion. But when I was watching the game yesterday, it was almost as if United were set up to do the classical United away, and suddenly they had to be a little bit more adventurous. So I actually thought the first half was a bit messy. And I think also in that formation, I know Mkhitaryan had a stinker, But I think he has to do too much. The way they were set up, he has to press about two or three players at the same time. So I think he's too tired to do any creative work. So I think that's why he completely fell out of the game. And then, of course, he's the guy who lost the ball when Chelsea scored. So perhaps he's going to end up on the bench now. But I don't... And I think second half as well, yes, I mean, they threw the kitchen sink and put four up front and Fellaini came on. But it was almost like, yeah, I'm going to stick closer forward. I'm going to stick on Fellaini and see what we can get from this.
Well, to be fair, Fellaini set up two very good chances to score.
They were both, he had one himself,
both for Chelsea, of course, but giving the ball away just in front of his own goal. But in terms of Man United's performance, the results have really fallen off since Pogba went out of the picture. Why doesn't Mata get a look in? It's not the first time this question's been asked, but why is Mata not involved? He wasn't even on the bench this
weekend. He wasn't. And the tendency or the suspicion when Mourinho took over was that his time at Manchester United would be done because he'd sold him to Manchester United from Chelsea. And initially, Mata actually did quite well at the arrangement. He played more games than most people thought. But, I mean, Mkhitaryan is clearly missing Paul Pogba. There's no doubt about that, because he's having to do some of the pressing work that Pogba would do. But he's an international footballer and he was a pretty expensive signing and he was a brilliant footballer in the Bundesliga. So relying on the availability of a fellow player is not a particularly good look for an elite footballer, I don't think.
Absolutely. With the money they've spent, Ahmed Habab says surely Mu will go after Ozil in the winter. This was a story that was... Yeah. Any fresh word on that?
Not that I've heard, but I still don't understand it. Mm. He doesn't strike me as a Mourinho player. There was that story not so long ago that Mourinho was sort of reduced to screaming in his face at Real Madrid, "Are you a man?" And I don't know what the answer was.
That answer, isn't it?
We are Devo, yeah. I hope. That 1 in 9 stat that I was enjoying so much towards the end of last week, which is now 1 in 10, of course, Mourinho, his team's away against top 6 sides, 1 goal scored. Daniel, you were pointing out in your excellent winners and losers column.
Thank you very much.
That the 7 games in that 10-game run with just 1 goal that he's had with Man United have only featured, this is 7 games, 13 shots on target.
Yeah, and 5 of those were away at Arsenal last season and 4 of them were away at Chelsea. So if you take 5 of those games, and I know that's slightly, you know, it's changing the statistic, but 5 of those games produced 4 shots on target.
Wow.
So when Manchester United are bad, they are smelly.
All right, well, Simba asks, is Mourinho just a deluxe Tony Pulis?
I'm not sure even being a deluxe Tony Pulis is a compliment at the moment.
He wins in 20, yeah.
I don't think he means it as a compliment. Is that a fair charge?
No, it's not a fair charge because there were reasons for appointing Jose Mourinho. One of them was to make Manchester United better, and he's done that. One of them was to attract the best players in the world that they wanted, and he's done that. The third was to turn them into title challengers, and he's not at the moment doing that, but he would argue it's still a work in progress.
It's interesting to note that away from home, Manchester United's record is only 1 point and 3 goals better than Brighton. Brighton under Chris Hughton, of course.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit about Chelsea, who actually won the game on Sunday afternoon. What was the reason for the difference in their performance? Was it the pre-game visit from Abramovich, the fact that Kante was playing, or the fact that David Luiz wasn't? Sasha?
I mean, Conte after the game said he finally had his first choice three in the middle, which was Kante, Cesc and Bakayoko, and then he also could bring and drink water. But I think overall there was much more sense of purpose, I thought, with Chelsea, because I think they actually had a plan to win the game, rather than United having an ad hoc plan, perhaps, to win the game. And for me, I think Morata actually did pretty well and the goal was excellent. And also, I think what helped as well, having Azpilicueta in his right place as part of the back three, because I think whenever they tried to shift him out to the right, it got disbalanced a little bit. I know Rudiger came on later and he did move out there, but I think overall Azpilicueta in the back three adds a lot of stability, and also Conte loves Azpilicueta and I think he loves having him in that position. And so I think overall as well, Conte talked about the balance that they had last season, and for him I think it was the first time this season they actually had a balance when approaching such a big game.
I'm fascinated by this idea that Man United was an ad hoc arrangement improvised by Mourinho after watching the first half of the Etihad. I'd love to know how that team talk went.
In fairness to Mourinho, he did this against Chelsea towards the end of last season. Everyone expected him to play deep and try and pick him off on the counter, and he went straight for their throat. On that occasion, of course, they won 2-0. And we should say, in his defence, had Marcus Rashford not closed his eyes and had the ball bounce off the top of his head, they might have got that lead that would have then enabled them to sit back. I mean, it's all...
But yet again, that would have been sort of United taking advantage of a mistake. In that case, I think by Courtois, who came out and just didn't quite make it.
That's how games are won.
Yeah, I would say most for football. Or perhaps even life.
Oh, interesting. Mm.
Let's have a quick word on Spurs, who are in third place and had their third straight win at Wembley. Sasha, you were there.
Yeah, and
I
had a busy weekend, three games. I actually really enjoyed the way Palace played.
Okay.
I thought they were. It was great to see the 4-4-2 with very tight spaces, you know, very textbook Hodgson. But it's taken him only a few games to learn to defend. Whereas, say, Klopp and Zidane did not really defend so well against the Spurs side. Of course, Spurs side had players missing, a third-choice goalkeeper and stuff like that. But I thought that Spurs were denied space. I thought that Townsend and Zaha looked really dangerous whenever Palace broke. I mean, Zaha did miss an open goal, taking advantage of a goalkeeping mistake. Mm. And also, I think very importantly, Palace's heads did not go down once they conceded, because at that stage they played quite well. I think Milivojevic and Kabai were a little bit too deep on the goal, but the heads didn't go down. They carried on playing, and I thought towards the end Spurs almost looked a little bit Spursy, slightly hanging on. Maybe something could fall here for Palace. And Sakho was brilliant. I think Liverpool fans would be looking at that going, Lovren against Kane 2 weeks ago, Sakho against Kane. Sakho basically turning Kane on 44th minute, ultimately confident player, lots of last-ditch tackles. He was everywhere.
Mm. Well, for all the positives for Palace, it is still their joint worst start ever to a top-flight campaign. The other time, by the way, that they had 4 points from their opening at 11, they actually finished 11th. Yeah. That was back in 2013-14 when Tony Pulis rode to their rescue, Sasha.
Could I just say as well, they do not look like a team that's fallen apart and is going to, you know, go down. For example, the way West Ham did against Liverpool the night before.
We'll hear more about that very soon. But you mentioned absences for Spurs. And I guess this is a good time to do a quick stock check on their squad, because Lloris out, who's been outstanding for them. Paolo Gazzaniga comes in, does brilliantly, no?
Hilariously.
Yeah. Oh, really? I thought he did well. Yeah, no?
There was a moment in the very early on in the game where he came for a cross and sort of flew at Mamadou Sakho, and it was almost as if the challenge was too weird for the referee, because he kind of kicked and punched Sakho, and the referee looked as if to say, well, I've never seen anything like that before, so I assume it's not a penalty. But you know what? It definitely was a penalty.
You know, that was so heartening for me, because Saturday afternoon I did exactly the same to a striker and the referee didn't give it, but the guy scored. But there was also the time he came for the through ball to Zaha. He came, stopped, came again, lethal. He was never going to make it. And then he also left a shot towards the end, fizzing past his post, and you could see the look in his eyes going, oh, that's much closer than I thought.
But, wow, okay, fair enough. What about, Dele Alli was out, and Son presumably playing in his place, and he scored a magnificent curl goal.
Just very coolly, very well taken. But Son is a very, well, people keep on saying, I think he's a very underrated player, to the extent that now I think everyone recognises how good
now
he
rated.
Is. Yeah, he's, yeah, I think he's now very much rated.
Okay, Harry Winks going off in that game as well. Concerns for England ahead of their friendlies coming up. We won't talk about that, though. There'll be plenty of chance over the international break. We'll hear more about Liverpool very shortly after this.
Tweet us at The Totally Football Show. Find us on Facebook and check us out at thetotallyfootballshow.com.
If Thursday's too long to wait to hear it again, listeners, bear in mind that you can traipse along. Good word, that traipse. Mm. Traipse along to the Glee Club in Birmingham this Wednesday night, and we'll be there. Are there any tickets left, producer Ben? Maybe. Have a look. Glee Club, their website. Also coming up soon, it's next month actually, is the FSF Awards. You can vote for your favourite writer, newspaper, player, website, and why not podcast at fsf.org.uk/vote. Daniel Story, you won FSF Writer of the Year Award last December. Has it changed your life?
Being presented the award by the Messrs. James Richardson is the life-changing moment. No, it hasn't changed my life, no.
I'm going to be presenting again this year.
Are you?
And I think everybody wants to see what happens when the podcast award comes up, because you just know how, you know, we're on rails and we're heading towards one outcome.
Plastic glasses.
Yeah. dear. Excellent. Oh, got some questions for you here. Phil C says, if in 5 years' time you have to extend your portrait of an icon book for a young player currently plying his trade, who do you predict it would be?
I think it would probably be Kylian Mbappe. I think he's the one that is on the road to stardom without pouring too much scorn on Marcus Rashford. I think Rashford is a great player and a great youngster, but Mbappe is the one with the real star potential. Although in that book, I didn't pick anyone under the age, currently under the age of 30. So
you wouldn't qualify. What were the criteria then for your icon button? Tell us more about it and where they can get, where they can get hold of it.
Very quickly, it's a portrait of 58 football players and coaches from the last 60 years. It's being sold to raise money for the Sir Bobby Robson Foundation, which is a charity that tries to find new ways to treat and beat cancer, and relies solely on funding. And all proceeds in the book go to the foundation. It can be bought from portraitofanicon.co.uk, which is linked through to the publisher website. And in terms of what makes an icon, ability, status, cult hero status, and but more importantly, I wanted it to be a sort of a look at the human side of players and coaches, because nobody wanted to read a list of Wikipedia entries.
Which was your favourite one to write?
My favourite one to write was probably Paul McGrath.
Oh, yeah? Why?
Because he is the most stark reminder I can think of that footballers are humans as well as players.
Ah.
I can highly recommend it. I read half of it in the Laundrette last week, and I did not want the spin cycle to end.
Right. Excellent. All right, well, here's another question for you. Howard Hockin, if Forest are finally moving back in the right direction, that's what you want to ask Daniel.
Yes, because they could not have moved further in the wrong direction.
All right, well, that might be discussed in more depth, I'm not sure, in your excellent Totally Football League show, which returns...
Will
it? Okay,
yeah,
cool.
We're doing a championship special.
Oh, right, there's a lot to talk about, isn't there?
There is a lot
from
to talk
one
about.
End to t'other.
Yeah.
Wolves back on top, Sheffield United staying second. 4-1, they beat Hull. Leon Clark, you should be doing all this bit, shouldn't you?
No, it's all right, you're saving me a job.
Leon Clark.
I'm delighted to say we'll be joined by Caroline Barker.
Boom.
As well.
Right.
So, it's going to be a really good show, all about the Championship.
Right. Oh, no FA Cup?
No, we won't be doing the FA Cup. A little break from the normal format.
Sorry, Boreham Wood fans.
Yep, get out.
Sunderland, the bottom of the Championship. You're going to be talking about that, I bet.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah. And you're going to be talking about Fulham statsman Klein.
Yes, some very interesting stuff coming out.
Can you give us a little hint about that? I know it was in Daniel Taylor's excellent Sunday column.
Yes, it's well worth reading Daniel Taylor's piece. He was brought in about a year and a half ago. It's been kind of nothing but trouble between him and the coaching team in differences of opinions over players.
He's the statsman.
Yeah, he's a statsman.
In terms of kind of analysing data for player acquisitions.
And apparently has his own models which failed to pick out Tammy Abraham and players like that.
Right.
He didn't have a great relationship there. He was fired and then spent the rest of the morning talking to police officers outside the stadium.
Was this to do with the sumo wrestling suit?
No, unconnected to that. Possibly connected to a number of tweets made in an account bearing his name, which were deleted shortly afterwards, which had some truly eye-popping allegations, which I'll expect we'll hear more of soon.
Wow. Well, let's hope you can get into those on Tuesday's show. Probably you think the suits will have their hands all over it.
Yeah, we probably won't be able to get into the exact nature of those allegations that were only made in a Twitter account bearing his name and may not have been made by him at all.
All right, then. Let's right now move back to Premier League news. And, Sasha, you went to the London Stadium on Saturday evening, where Liverpool have now scored 8 goals in their last 2 visits, which is the same tally as West Ham have managed in their last 9 games there.
I'm not surprised. I think West Ham just make it very easy for Liverpool to play against them. It was slightly different formation in May, but this time I think Mane's return was basically spelled the end for West Ham. It was interesting, after the game, Klopp said that he only decided Mane will come back after just one training session on Thursday. He said he looked at him, he's like a little machine, he's going to be absolutely fine. And then he said basically the formation was slightly ad hoc. I mean, when I started watching the game, it looked like a 4-3-3 to me, but for some reason with Wijnaldum at the base of midfield, and I was like, this can't be right. And then gradually it sort of shifted and rotated about 30 degrees, became almost a 4-2-4, which Klopp claimed was defensive because it had 2 sixes in the middle. But for me, it was basically ideal to pick off West Ham, which is exactly what they did after about 20 minutes of messing around. Corner breaks. West Ham do have 3 players back, as Bielisch pointed out after the game, but they're just not tracking, and that's basically game over. And second half, Bielisch tried to change it, went to a 4-4-2, but they just left more space for Liverpool. Yes, West Ham rallied a little bit, but it looked to me that basically Liverpool can score at will. So West Ham scored, Liverpool went, all right, we're just going to put it beyond any reach. very nice for Oxlade-Chamberlain, who finally had like a proper game for Liverpool.
Right.
And Klopp, I think, was speaking yesterday or today saying, well, he was just trying to get him up to speed with the whole ethos, the pressing, you know, how Liverpool play. And he looked good. Again, well, it's been the league against West Ham, but he looked on the same wavelength as the rest of the players.
Hmm.
And in the end, it was just a procession. Salah with two goals, exquisite finish for the fourth, and it could have been eight. And
right.
After the game, Bilic was saying, I am not a broken man, but he looked a broken man. Interestingly enough, he usually recently has been very quiet in his press conferences and you can hardly hear what he says.
Yes.
This time he was actually speaking properly, so I think he knew.
All right. Jonathan Liu tweeting, lots of West Ham fans trying to beat the traffic by staying to the end of the game. things in a very bad place at the London Stadium. And Moyes... Neville, that's the partnership that apparently is going to turn things around.
Which is an interesting manoeuvre.
Do you know how many of his last 54 matches as a manager? You do, don't you, Daniel? Because I nicked this out your column.
Let's test Ian, though.
How many of his last 54 matches as a manager has David Moyes won?
I will say 5.
Oh, that's harsh, but it's 10.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Wow, where did he get them from?
You've stolen my thunder by undercutting me. he was in charge of Man United for a while, so... I presume that fits into
no,
the...
No, that's Sociedad. Most
that's
of those
Sociedad
are a little run at Sociedad. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's a bold move, and I'm not 100% convinced it's going to go through, given the reaction from West Ham fans, which has been a factor for that club before. There are other managers available, and it's just an incredibly bold move to pick someone who, while in one sense is perfect for the job in that he has in the past taken over a club seemingly set for relegation, turned them around, stabilised them and lifted them into the top eight. It was 15 years ago.
Mm.
And his last three jobs have been, say, unmitigated disasters. I will watch it with interest, certainly.
Right.
Why not Allardyce?
I think there's a few reasons.
Yeah. Is that what they need? Somebody who just comes in and strips away all the frippery and just gets back to basics?
Well, certainly Allardyce being connected with Everton makes less sense in terms of players and how they might set up than Allardyce being connected with West Ham. Okay, there's political factors involved and stuff, but the West Ham squad for the last 18 months, I don't think there's been any direction in terms of sort of the ethos of what this team is supposed to be doing.
Is it a bad squad?
It's hard to say because, I mean, for example, they signed Arnautovic, came on Saturday and spent 30 minutes just waving his arms at everything. It was absolutely useless. So it's if someone maybe can get these players together somehow, but they just look like basically a mob at the moment.
If you were to listen to the Muddy Knees Media produced Football Manager Files, a collection of interviews with managers assembled over the past year or so, you would hear Slaven Bilic talking quite openly and very fascinatingly about the way that he works on the training field. And one of the things that he said he does is he tries to create a kind of platform and then leave the players to essentially, you know, express themselves.
He's like the drummer, setting up a rhythm and they're just jazz musicians.
And they're off noodling, I believe the term is. Now, that when it's going well, that looks like genius. When it's not, it's obviously very, very easy to make certain accusations like, Jesus, Henry Christ, what the hell were you doing only leaving Aaron Cresswell back at a corner? They're really good on the counter-attack. Did you not know this? Oh, my God, this is so bad. Being the general assessment of most West Ham fans in the stadium, it was, I think, long overdue. I quite liked him. I really liked chatting to him. He's very generous with his time, very interesting. But I can't help thinking that the end of last season was probably the time to do this.
Right. Liverpool looked good though, didn't they, Daniel?
Yeah, Mohamed Salah is very quickly becoming the dominant force in that attack, which is strange because it's an attack that very much has worked as a unit rather than individual component parts. He scored 12 goals in all competitions now, and Philippe Coutinho was top scorer for them with 14 last season, which shows just
They're top scorer in all competitions for last season.
Yeah.
14 goals.
Yeah, Philippe Coutinho, because they shared the goals around, which they haven't done as much. Interestingly, Salah has had three times as many shots on target as any other Liverpool player.
Really?
Yeah, he has dominated that attack while still being a component part.
He misses so many that with anyone else, you would wonder about his composure. He's just keeps going at it, keeps running, keeps shooting.
Yeah, no worries about his composure on Saturday, but also on Saturday he actually ended up as the forward
Yeah, second striker, didn't he?
Well, he was actually, if you look at the average position after the game, Firmino was deeper than him. So basically, it was Salah up front.
Wow. Can you name any other players who have slotted into a new team as seamlessly and successfully as Mo Salah at Liverpool, says Jamie Hutchins?
Well, they were raving about Mane last season, but Salah's doing better.
Yeah, you would say better than Mane last season?
Yeah, certainly more goals and just more involved.
Ian Wright at Arsenal.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a good shout.
Scored in his debut, carried on scoring pretty much forever.
Mane being back, by the way, of course, huge news for the last round of African World Cup qualifiers, which is sees Senegal taking on South Africa. That's a big game.
But they're replaying one as well, aren't they?
They are, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll find out and do a proper roundup in Thursday's show. Right, what else happened this weekend? Ian, you've got a Seagulls story, so let's talk about Swansea and Brighton. Headline from Cornwall Live this summer, Seagull attacks are on the rise and people are getting injuries in their mouths, say pharmacists.
Injuries in their mouth?
Yeah, I guess pecking.
Oh, really?
Sounds like an excuse.
Yeah.
It was a seagull. I don't know. I mean, I want to read more about that.
Well, I lived in Cornwall for a bit in the late 90s. They are the size of dogs. They are absolutely enormous. The only surprise in the last 20 years is that we haven't had a story about one of them grabbing a toddler and flying off with it. They are big and they're aggressive. They're organised and intelligent. you know, it's taken a while for me to actually talk about this, but we used to be plagued by them out the back window of our house.
When you lived in Cornwall?
When we lived in Cornwall, yeah. They'd line up along the back fence and then just... all the time.
You were like Tippi Hedren.
It was hideous, and I did what I thought was very clever. I got a shaving mirror, and as the sun set behind them, I deflected the rays of the sun into
like
the seagull's
Archimedes.
Eyes. Well, very much so.
Was it Archimedes?
With more seagulls.
It was Archimedes at the Siege of Syracuse.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And it was like a shooting gallery. Knocking them off the fence. Down they all went. I thought it was all very, very good. Off I went to the pub to celebrate. The next morning...
They had the mirror.
Back with shades.
The next morning, I woke up... And the room looked very different. You know when it's been snowing and the room and it looks really different?
They got into your room?
I opened the curtains and the window, you couldn't see out of it.
You're kidding. Thick
white with seagull poo.
No way.
They must have spent all night launching attack run after attack run, emptying their bowels.
Were the windows in the house, were they similarly plastered?
Untouched. Only the window from whence the light came was covered. Seagulls are terrifying.
Seagulls. Hey, which brings us on nicely, etc. and so on.
To Glenn Murray.
To Glenn.
Who also covered Swansea with his own efforts.
Right. Swansea are dropping. They're now second bottom in the Premier League. Not a great game, this one. 15 shots, but a fantastic result for Brighton. We mentioned they're up in seventh now, level with Arsenal and Liverpool on points. Glenn Murray, how many goals is that since the start of last season?
27.
It's a lot of goals.
23 of them in the second flight.
Yeah, but four in the Premier League.
Yeah, in the last three games as well, which is interesting because I was down at Brighton for the Everton game and I thought Murray looked a little bit slow, a little out of form and not really much of a threat, which once again proves that I am stealing a living.
Five defeats in six at home for Swansea, who are facing real problems. Daniel?
Yeah, that Swansea kind of did a budget version of what Everton did this summer by selling their best player and their most creative player, which was obviously Guildford Sigurdsson, to Everton, and then basically replaced him with everything but. They bought three central midfielders. I think it's fair to say Renato Sanchez has been the disappointment of this season. They bought Wilfred Bonny back after 2 years of pretty miserable form. And they have got their hopes resting on 20-year-old Tammy Abraham's shoulders. And yes, they look pretty wretched at the moment. Last season, they changed managers twice between August and January, and it wouldn't be any surprise if this run continues if Clement paid the same price.
Unfortunate. Brighton up in eighth place. Huddersfield, fellow newly promoted side, what are they, 10th? And Burnley, a 7th. Level with Liverpool and Arsenal. Cocu fetishists says, can someone explain to me the Burnley mystery? I guess it's the mystery of how they're doing so well on the road when that used to be their Achilles heel and what they're doing up there.
Yeah, I mean, the mystery on Saturday was to play a Southampton team who had 13 shots and barely put one on target, and Burnley had, what, I think one shot on target and scored it.
Wow.
Which is kind of what they've been doing all season. They've just been taking their chances. They've been efficient, I think we'd say.
So does that suggest that they're going to regress to the mean? Or you can't sustain that level of efficiency.
I am prepared to go out there now and put my neck on the line and say they will not finish seventh in the Premier League. but they won't go down, which is that was their aim at the start of the season.
Will they still have Sean Dyche when we return from the international break?
I actually hope not. Not for their sake, that sounds horrible. But I hope that Everton take a chance on him. I hope that I think he has earned that opportunity. That people will say he plays a different brand of football at Burnley and he plays, you know, eye bleeding style of Pulis, but he plays exactly what Burnley needed. And there is nothing to suggest that he wouldn't change that when he went to another club and fit his methods to fit the players he has. And there is no doubt that he is the performing manager in the Premier League at the moment.
There's right. also a bit of perception here. I mean, this isn't great timing because I think Burnley's XG for fans of these sort of things was 0.17 at the weekend and they still won. But we are talking about a man who played two up top for Burnley's entire season when he got them up in the first place. I think Daniel's right. He does what Burnley need to do. But there's not one player in there who gives anything less than everything he's got. They're very well organised. They're very good at set pieces. Yes, I still take Michael Cox's point that Everton don't really have those sort of players, but that's why there's a vacancy. And that's what he needs to do. The only thing about Dyche that I am worried about is his attitude, which sounds a bit strange, but he can be very, very prickly with the press and anyone who criticises him. He said to me once that he got he'd have people come up to him and say, "Oh, have you considered playing a back three?" And he'd say, "What do you do for a living?" I'd be like, "Oh, right, a plumber. How long have you been a plumber?" 35 years. "Right, well, I've been in football for 35 years and I know what I'm doing." And if he does
sounds
that...
Sounds quite fair, to be
it
honest.
It is absolutely fair, but it's a question of PR. If he does that, or if he gets tattooed with journalists, or he has what appears to be the perfect balance of a chip on both shoulders, up in Merseyside, under far more scrutiny, he will make his own problems. But as a manager, I think he's brilliant.
Also, I think the plucky little Burnley thing isn't going to work at Everton. The fans will really dislike that.
Yes, that's true.
"You got a great stat," says Frost29, Daniel, "about English managers from 1950 to 1970. Is that right? Or from the age of 50 to 70?
Yeah, it's this perception that young British coaches are being held back by the arrival of foreign managers is to an extent valid, but seven of the last 13 managers appointed in the Premier League are Brits between the ages of 50 and 70. And the favourite for the West Ham job to replace Slaven Bilic is David Moyes, who would be another in that category. There's the barrier to young British coaches. It's kind of this lack of... Ian said that it was a bold move to choose Moyes, and I think that's right in an extent, but it's also a pretty unimaginative move.
Right.
It's,
so the obstacle is the same old names that are hanging around cluttering up the opportunities as opposed to foreign managers.
Yeah, I think the term British manager is now almost interchangeable with Sam Allardyce or Tony Pulis or David Moyes. They're seen as firefighters, and therefore if you want a firefighter, you go British. If you want someone to be a bit sexy, you go foreign, which is very stereotypical, but that's kind of where English football is now.
Who are the sexiest British managers, young, under 50?
Eddie Howe is sexy and British. About it.
No, but
this is why I want Sean Dyche to get the Everton job, because I think he's earned it. And I think if he doesn't get it, he very quickly, you know, he's manager of the team in seventh at the moment. So where does he go from there? Because he's not going to get a top six job because he's not shown it at a club anywhere like those top six clubs. So I hope he gets Everton so we can, if only, so we can stop this interminable cyclical argument of they don't get a chance and they'd be really good.
Ian, let's have some more sexy young English managers.
Well, to be honest, there aren't really any within range of a Premier League job. You look at the Championship, Wolves is Nuno, he's not going anywhere. Chris Wilder was with Northampton, now with Sheffield United, doing incredibly well. But that would be a very rapid step up from dealing with lower league players to dealing with Premier League players. Neil Warnock's at Cardiff. Lee Johnson was on the brink of the sack with Bristol City last season. Steve Bruce is at Villa. Gary Rowett still got to prove himself at Derby. Not any names, really.
Okay.
The most interesting one at the moment is Paul Hurst at Shrewsbury, who's done incredibly well getting them up to the top when they were almost relegated to the fourth division. But I would have thought he would be the kind of person Sunderland should be looking for. I think it's a bit of a leap to say Shrewsbury to the Premier League.
I think my nomination would probably be Kevin Nolan. He's top of the league with Notts County at the moment, in, albeit in League Two, but... Having spoken to him,
does he still do the chicken celebration?
He doesn't. But having spoken to him, he is an ambitious manager. And There was not so long ago that both the Bolton and West Ham jobs looked like they might become available, and you could see in his eyes that he saw his path to the top, and he's done brilliant things at Notts County, so I don't think he'll be there for that long.
He would have a big advantage in that, you know, he's played at that level, he knows those players. That's always going to be the problem. They're two very different sports now, dealing with people who are earning £300-400 a week and dealing with people who are earning £80,000 a week. So it's almost like a completely different vocation.
Fair enough. Is David Unsworth sexy?
Oh, yeah.
That come from behind, and please, I didn't mean those two sentences to go in such close proximity. Against Watford at the weekend, certainly got a lot of temperatures rising, heart rates racing, that kind of thing. So they were 2-0 down in a crazy second half, not least because it went on for almost an hour, and they came back to win 3-2 thanks to a late missed penalty in the, what, 100th minute?
101st, I think.
Wow.
I've seen a penalty scored in the 101st minute before. Dirk Kuyt against Arsenal? Maybe it was 99th. But here the big factor was the substitute goalkeeper. So Nias knees Gomez in the head.
Right.
That's the stoppage. Gomez comes off. Carnegie comes on. And, yeah, he just runs out of his penalty box, misses the ball. Nias walks it in. And Watford are shambles after that. So I think that moment was when Watford broke. And Everton got a little bit lucky. And also, like I'm told by the Everton fans who were at the match, once that first goal went in, the Goodison Park became a very, very hostile place. There was no way Watford were going to survive that. And basically Everton just went kitchen sink and everything at them. And Watford couldn't cope with the intensity at all, especially with the dodgy keeper at the back.
It's a good sign, though, that they have that intensity again after... You've seen recent performances when the blood was up at Goodison. Certainly the home result against Lyon... there was a lot of...
The away result against Lyon.
And then they followed that with... But what I'm saying is that the passion was there, but the result wasn't. But anyway, after three defeats in a row, including, as you say, most recently on Thursday, a 3-0 scoreline away at Lyon, this is a massive boost for the club, but it doesn't change anything. Unsworth still going to go, is he?
It makes it slightly more awkward because you do see a result and a performance and a noise like that as something to build on. But they may be too far down the road already. But it was certainly the result the club needed. It was also what I needed, because a couple of weeks ago I referred to Everton's young defensive midfielder as Benny Banging Time. His actual name is Benny Beningaby. So I'm happy to set the record straight.
I must say as well, actually, in Unsworth, propping up Unsworth, all his subs were involved in the three goals. Lookman played the pass for the first one, Calvert-Lewin scored the second, and Lennon won the penalty.
There you go. Let's take another little pause and we'll be back with more exciting things from around the world, actually.
Producer Ben here, people. And you know, I was talking to our friend Raphael Honigstein recently, and he was telling me when it comes to cars, he drives a BMW. When it comes to sausage, it's got to be Bratwurst. When it comes to pudding, it's Black Forest Gatto. And when it comes to stubble, he is all about Cornerstone. Why? It's all about the German engineering, of course. Cornerstone super sharp blades are made in the fatherland, so you know you're getting the absolute best. And right now, you can pick up a personally engraved razor and 6 super sharp blades delivered right to your door for just £4. All you have to do is head to cornerstone.co.uk/totally.
Hey, we've got so much stuff still to talk about. Listeners, I hope you've got a while for us yet. Where do you want to go next? Do you want to talk about Celtic in Scotland breaking their own domestic record? 63 games unbeaten, this after a 4-0 win over St Johnstone. Is this terrible news if, like, for 63 games, no one's been able to put a hand on them?
Yeah, Brendan Rodgers understandably came out after the game and did what Brendan Rodgers does, which is talk up the impressive nature of the run, talk up the strength of the squad, talk up the, you know, the stamina within the team to go, you know, the lack of complacency. But yeah, there's no doubt that competition has barely been lower over the course of that run. And Celtic fans will not mind one little bit if they win every game for the next 100 and the next 3.5 seasons, if it means they win every trophy. But there has to come a stage where when Celtic are unable to compete in Europe, but unable to have any competition at home, then the whole thing's become slightly farcical without me inviting a torrent of abuse from their supporters.
No, and any prospect of Rangers closing the gap has been diminished by, well, events of 5 or so recent years. They are now linked with a new manager, though that is Steve McLaren, apparently.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Where is Steve McLaren now?
Possibly Glasgow.
Yeah. Producer Ben says he's in Israel.
Is he?
Huh?
Well, I tell you what, we'll ask Celtic fan Kevin Bridges at our live show at the Indigo, which is coming up later on in November.
Nice.
Turkey, did you see that extraordinary moment in the under-17 clash, which we were all watching live between Fenerbahce and Galatasaray? Sasha?
Knee height at the knee.
Flying
across the pitch.
It's the is it the worst tackle you've ever seen?
Well, not to get sent off for, yeah. Got a yellow.
Yeah, and you know, you've watched Liverpool for years, and that. But yeah, you only got a yellow. It's extraordinary. It was kind of, in its violence, it was quite similar to Patrice Evra's effort ahead of their Europa League clash with Guimarães.
Evra aimed a little bit higher.
Right.
At the guy's head.
What? Any latest info on that? Poor Patrice. I feel bad, and I know I shouldn't be siding with the man who kicked somebody else in the head, but he's a lovely chap, and you just feel that something must have been said to him repeatedly for him to do that.
Well, he actually, before the game, he came out and basically offered out the Marseille end.
Ah.
People came down. I think then they went back on the pitch. Then the whole kicking in the head thing happened.
Right.
And then he got sent off and was taking pictures with two kids. But at the weekend's match against Caen, which Marseille won 5-0, there were numerous banners against him. So, for example, you thought you were above the institution of Olympique Marseille and its supporters. We don't want you in our colours anymore. Evra, f*** you. F*** off. This game is over. And love for the shirt, respect for the supporters, professionalism. Is it too much to ask?
Right.
So I don't think there's any way back with the fans there.
I don't want to... Yeah, I shouldn't be taking sides in that. I would suggest, though, that Evra probably can't live in that city anymore then, because this is a town where bombs get placed and that kind of thing. Anyway, but lovely, also, lovely place, though.
Also in that game, a lovely celebration. Tovin scored the second goal and then went off and grabbed the camera and started filming all his mates.
Yeah, I actually find that annoying when footballers grab a camera and pretend to be
I haven't really seen anyone to grab a camera before.
Oh, yeah, have you not? Totti did it.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Oh, but he was in himself, but he was a massive camera.
You get people actually doing it with the TV cameras, and possibly Totti did that as well. All right. Yeah, I'm not a fan of that. It's like kissing the camera. I don't like that either.
Also violence in Saint-Étienne.
Yeah, so what was this riot? Nabi Fekir?
So basically, Saint-Étienne-Lyon, the ancient derby, and Lyon managed to record the biggest ever win, 5-0 at Saint-Étienne. And for anyone who's been to the cities, I mean, they're very, very different. Saint-Étienne historically, I think, was gun-making, and now it's mostly warehouses.
Isn't it mining town, Saint-Étienne?
I think it was mining and gun. There was a lot of armory there as well. And obviously, Lyon is this big, affluent, glamorous place next to it.
Gastronomic capital of France.
Oh, it's beautiful. It is a beautiful place. And also a lovely stadium. Gerland, well, the old stadium, big fan of that. So basically, Lyon are hammering Saint-Etienne, it's 4-0. Nabil Fekir scores in the 86th minute, one-on-one, just puts it away, takes off his shirt, holds it up to the Saint-Etienne fans, his mates mob him, next thing you know, the fans are on the pitch. And the game was held up for, I think it was 30, 40 minutes, and I think they pretty much finished in the empty stadium. And one wonders what's going to happen to Saint-Etienne. Now, because I remember last season there was a riot as well, the stadium was closed, and then the whole section of them, Saint-Étienne fans, just turned up to the next game and, you know, carried on supporting the team as though nothing happened.
Yeah, they climbed in over the... I think they got through the museum shop, had access. They went into the shop and managed to... It was very clever. Anyway, how was he? Did he manage to escape unscathed?
I think all the players escaped unscathed. Then some actually very good goals in there. Fekir's first, Depay scored again, and Lyon looking pretty decent there in third place in France.
Brilliant, Sasha. This has been an excellent Ligue 1 roundup. In Germany, make you want to jump your Pinkers, that is. They won another game. That's all they do is win. 3-1 away at Borussia Dortmund, the Sigl Iduna Park. Jadon Sancho made a brief appearance, and they extend their lead at the top of the Bundesliga.
It's an 11-point swing since Jupp's
kidding,
taken over,
yeah.
I think.
Wow. All right.
Dortmund now 1 point in four games.
Second biggest swing we've seen in and you know where I'm going, don't you? Robin Zentner, the Mainz keeper.
Ooh, yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah, the ball's passed back to him, and the goalkeeper seems to be unaware of the concept of the ball that can move.
I thought it did stop and then rolled on.
But he didn't control it properly, and then obviously it still had some momentum and moved, but it was the glorious moment was obviously him attempting to kick the ball and no ball being there.
So the ball he's looked up, and in the meantime the ball has rolled away, but in his peripheral vision, the penalty spot resembles the ball.
Right,
it's a Gestalt law of similarity
I was just going to say that,
His brain filled in the gaps for him.
Exactly. He sees a white disc and the ball's white and swings at it and the look of confusion that is... and you can imagine it. I mean, we've... Yeah.
I feel cheated, though, that it didn't end up in as a goal.
It very nearly
did. That really takes the edge off it.
Yeah. In Spain... Barcelona stay 4 points clear of Valencia. They dusted off Paco Alcacer and he scored two goals. And she's got 8 in 9 starts, which is pretty impressive since he never starts for Barcelona. Real Madrid also won against Las Palmas. Was it 3-0 in the end or 2? It was 3-0, was it? Asensio's second, though, Daniel. Did you see that?
Yeah, he is a little dreamboat. And at the moment, given the climate at the Bernabeu, he's worth sticking on to because... Karim Benzema and Ronaldo, I think, have got one goal this season in the league.
Wow.
And Asensio is the reason for hope through this very, very sticky run. Just deserves to be starting more games.
Mm. He hit that ball so hard. I honestly cannot remember a ball being struck that hard.
Really?
Ever. Yeah.
It's a gorgeous goal. Have a look at that. We'll talk about Italy a little bit in a bit. But let's just tidy up the rest of the Premier League weekend. Bournemouth got a win away at Newcastle. That's a big win for Eddie Howe. Sexy, yeah. Eddie Howe.
Just a bit. It gets them out of the bottom three. They didn't look like it was on the cards for the first half. Newcastle were the better team. And then...
It was the 91st minute or so, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it was coming.
Daniel's favourite, Steve Cook.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I'm a huge Steve Cook fan.
Why are you a huge Steve Cook fan?
Because I have a slightly bizarre tendency to latch onto players and give them too much love. Too much individual love, and I think he could easily have been called up to the England squad if he wasn't playing for Bournemouth maybe 18 months ago. He's had a slightly tricky time. He's got a newborn baby, and he didn't said in an interview that had kind of held him back. But he's a bit of a rags to riches story, Steve Cook. There was a fantastic interview with George Colkin in the Times with him maybe a year ago, where he spoke about having to basically save up money for petrol to get to and from training, and he's now an established Premier League defender and a very good one.
Right, excellent. And the man who got them 3 points at the weekend. 3 points for Huddersfield as well, up in 10th, as we mentioned. And their home record, only United, City and Arsenal have done better at home than the Terriers.
Did you see the goal?
I think I did. What?
Van La Parra, who picks up about 35
Wijnaldum's
yards
cousin.
Out. Oh, mm-hmm. I did not know that.
Yeah.
35 yards out and no one closes him down. So he thinks, yeah, why not? And he does.
Certainly did.
Top bins.
Little stat about Huddersfield. That only Manchester City, Manchester United and Tottenham have kept more clean sheets this season than them, which that wasn't what they were known for in the Championship last season.
Not at all. Also shout out to Lursel. Three saves all game, but two of them in injury time, and they were lovely.
Mm.
And he got mobbed after the game by his teammates because he definitely saved them the win.
Tony Pulis was known for clean sheets, but not anymore, Daniel.
No, he is... the next man for the chop, I think.
Do you think?
Yeah, if you speak to West Brom, it's one of those...
Has Tony Pulis ever been fired mid-season?
I don't think so, no. He always left in May.
There's a very notion sprains my brain.
I think he was at Gillingham.
Oh, really?
So that might have been more to do with a fallout with Paul Scally, the chairman.
Okay. But anyway, sorry.
Yeah, I think there's a conception that because it's Tony Pulis, West Brom will be all right. But if you speak to their supporters, particularly the ones that go away from home... it's awful football, and the best way of describing it is that they don't look like creating chances, never mind scoring at the moment. They've on a winless run of 10 games, but that run includes Stoke, Leicester, Brighton, Huddersfield, poor Premier League teams in comparison with their ambitions. And when Tony Pulis loses the ability to make a side stubborn, and when he loses the ability to keep a side out of the bottom four or five, the reasons for keeping him... They fall away pretty quickly, and so does the goodwill he accrues, because the football isn't great.
Sometimes changing manager can do the world a good. Take the example of Leicester, who came up with an exciting 2-2 draw away at Stoke. Things very exciting under Claude Puel.
Yeah, they're scoring goals, and while Southampton failed to score goals, Claude Puel's reputation kind of grows twice, once for his old club and once for his new. And obviously they didn't win, but a draw at Stoke for Leicester is perfectly adequate. I think they've scored two goals in every game he's managed them.
Right, is it three games now?
Yep, it's not very many, is it?
And why didn't they win this weekend? Peter Crouch.
Yes.
Peter Crouch. Who Mark Schwarzer wants England to take along as a plan B. How do you feel about that?
I think it's a plan
Yeah, I think it might be a few letters later in the alphabet than that.
But scores goals.
But God bless him.
In the scoring charts of English players in the Premier League this season, he's probably right up there, isn't he?
Right up there, though I do think he might be 37 by the time the World Cup rolls about. I think there might be other options. But the best thing about that game, the noise that Shaqiri's goal made.
Oh.
Because it hit the stanchion and gave it a really good resounding thud.
Mm.
I always think that should count double.
Was it a thud or a doing?
No, it was very much a toom.
Okay.
Like that.
It was also very unusual because he scored from inside the box. It wasn't like one of those belters that he usually does.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Shaqiri will be in action against Northern Ireland on Thursday. Well, you imagine if he's picked. But Danny, are you doing a preview for this?
Yeah, well, I will do as a sort of midweek column we do.
Right.
I think there was an air of celebration between within Northern Ireland fans when they drew Switzerland, and clearly Croatia and Italy were you know, are good teams, but Switzerland won their first 9 qualifiers.
Yeah, I mean, the big story of the end of qualifying was how on earth Switzerland, who'd been on that amazing run, they got the best ever points haul. They actually finished with more points than 5 of the 9 group winners, and yet they're still in the playoffs. And according to FIFA rankings, they are the toughest team Northern Ireland could draw.
I think the difficulty for Northern Ireland is that Switzerland are, like them, a team that's better than its component parts. They're
right.
not a, you know, they're the antidote to Portugal, let's say.
They've got some pretty good players.
Yeah, they have. And they've got players who are, quite a lot of players who are 25 and under. So they're you know, bags full of energy.
Right.
I fear for Northern Ireland, I'm afraid.
Who's their star forward now for Switzerland?
Is this Seferovic?
Yeah.
I think he's a bit of a cart horse.
They've got Dermich as well, haven't they? But he wasn't in the last squad. But yeah, Seferovic is the one.
All right. Got goals out of midfield with Shaqiri. They've got Jan Sommer, decent keeper. Lig Steiner, who's still doing it now.
I mean, he's, I think 33 now. But yeah, he's kind of their rock.
All right. Northern Ireland only lost one competitive game at Windsor Park in 4 years. Absolutely crucial. This first leg's at home, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's crucial that they get the result and a big one here.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I fear for them. I suspect that the Swiss are too organised for them as a team. Northern Ireland clearly didn't limp into the playoffs, but this feels like their level, if I'm honest.
Really?
I fear for them. I think the Swiss will do what needs to be done in the away leg and then beat them at home.
All right. We shall see. That's Thursday night. And as we mentioned before, Northern Ireland trying to reach the first World Cup since 1986. Switzerland were at the last one, reached the last 16, where I think Argentina put them out on penalties, didn't they?
That does ring a bell.
So, you know, bit of a pedigree there. The other Thursday night playoff is Croatia against Greece, which is worth mentioning, certainly for two reasons. One, best kits in international football, Croatia.
Oh, yeah.
One
yeah, fair chance.
Peru. Yeah. I'd always put Peru
okay,
above.
OK, Peru.
Love
one of the best two kits in international football. And the other thing is Greece, who come into this, you know, traditional fashion with an amazing record for a gritty defensive work. However, they're going to be missing arguably their best exponent of that, Kostas Manolas. He's been suspended by FIFA for trying to manipulate his disciplinary record.
Well,
yeah, he's found guilty of intentionally seeking a yellow card. He basically time wasted in the 90th minute of their win over Cyprus, which meant that he missed the game against Gibraltar, fair dues, and they won 4-0 anyway. But FIFA, and I can't remember this ever happening before, have gone back and said, we're on to you, Sonny, so we're going to ban you anyway for the first leg of the playoffs.
Because David Beckham did this.
Yes.
David Beckham
did he get done for
took
it?
A swipe. No, but he did admit to it immediately afterwards.
Right.
Which seemed to be like a cry for recognition that he's not as thick as everyone thought. I was like, no.
But why didn't this guy just kick the ball away? That would be much easier to get booked, no?
Hmm. I mean, it happens, but I don't remember people being suspended for it. Right. Okay, well, that's coming up on Thursday as well. Of course, there's all sorts of other big matches, including a massive one for the Italians and their hopes of getting to the World Cup. We'll talk about all of that sort of thing on Thursday, when we'll have a proper Italian section as well with James Horncastle coming in. Among the stories we'll no doubt be covering there is news of the Minardi of football. Benevento is the analogy of Minardi in Formula One, who have lost all their games so far. But oh my word, on Saturday they were 66-1 away at Juventus, but they went and took the lead with a rare goal. A beautiful free kick as well from Amato Ciccioretti.
Badly set wall. He left the Szczesny left the he could curl it around the wall, basically. He didn't cover his corner.
Oh, well, anyway.
Sorry.
No romance, Sasha.
Juventus came back, Higuain and Cuadrado, and et cetera. Do you, so now Benevento have lost, was it, a 12 now? Do you know who was the last side to lose their first 12 games in a season?
Give us a clue with the country, James.
Sasha, you know?
Man United, early 30s.
You are absolutely right. 30-31 Man United. That one caught me by
surprise.
I've
been looking at these things.
Yeah.
Also, I think, yes. For me, the sort of the team with the lowest points total ever is Tasmania Berlin. They were, I think, were in the third season of the Bundesliga. They got promoted completely randomly for political reasons because they needed the Berlin team in the Bundesliga. And they picked up, I think, 8 points, which would have been 10 points in the new currency.
Right.
And they're often seen as the team completely out of their depth.
What was their name again?
Tasmania Berlin.
Tasmania? Why were they called Tasmania Berlin?
I read something that it was something to do with the guys who were founding and thinking of moving to Australia or something in the early 20th century.
Right.
And they scored 15 goals that season.
Well, they certainly were down under in a very real sense.
Very real sense, yeah. And but Derby, actually, if you go point for point, when they picked up their 11, did worse than Tasmania.
Right. Well, Benevento look a safe bet to pip both of those to the world title for worst ever season. So no points at all from 12 games. So a third of the way through the season, effectively. Almost.
Can I mention one thing? The place Benevento is actually like ancient Roman settlement. Mm-hmm. It used to be called Malevento, which obviously bad events happen here.
Yeah.
So at some stage, the locals turned around and went, actually, let's get a nicer name. So back in the ancient times, it became Benevento from Malevento.
Wow. There's probably like an old Indian cemetery there or something, isn't there? Burial ground.
Barry,
you'd think.
Need Barry Fry to...
Now, elsewhere in Serie A, other things we'll talk about on Thursday, no doubt, is exciting... Serie A title race, which now features the top three teams within 2 points of each other. Juve have moved into second with that win ahead of Inter, who only drew. Napoli, who are on top, drew as well. We mentioned Goulam's injury in our Champions League coverage last week and the impact that might have. Certainly, very possibly part of the issue there in the draw with Chievo. Roma had a big win away at Fiorentina. That's now 12 away league wins in a row for Di Francesco's side. And Milan, that game they had to win to save Vincenzo Montella, they did win it. They did win it, yep. 2-0. Second, a beauty from Suso, who one of the stories, really, of this last season and a half has been how well he's been doing since his move to the Rossoneri. They're up to a giddying seventh place. And no doubt that whole one game to save Montella's job will be back up and running in a fortnight's time. George Weah is still not president of Liberia.
God damn it.
How many more rounds?
Well, no, the latest voting, the runoff, that's been suspended by Liberia's Supreme Court, who ruled that a case alleging widespread fraud in the first round should be heard. How about that? Just keeping you up to date, Daniel, on the Liberian presidential elections.
I'm offended you didn't think I already was up to
date. No, beg your pardon. Anything else that you would like to mention?
I would like to mention, Premier League-wise, just how bad Southampton are at shooting.
Okay.
Claude Puel, when he was appointed at Leicester, was pretty bolshy in his first press conference when he was accused of playing boring football. And he said, to paraphrase, he said, look at those strikers I've just left behind. Look at the strikers I've got here. Don't worry about it. And that is completely proven out. Southampton... they rank fifth for chances created and shots on target this season. They rank 19th and 20th for shot conversion and shot accuracy. They are terrible in the final third. Absolutely terrible. And they've not even played many good teams yet. And if you're looking for a team that might fall into crisis and get relegated this season, they would be my shout, because they are, unless they improve very quickly in front of goal, and this has been happening for sort of 2 years now, they are going to get dragged into trouble very quickly.
Right. They are currently 4 points clear of the drop.
Mm.
They go away to Liverpool. Then they have what I presume will be a resurgent Everton under Sean Dyche at home. And then they go away to Man City. So it's not a nice little run coming.
Mm.
But I don't think you expected fireworks from Pellegrini, because he was very miserly at Alaves last season. So this sort of makes sense.
The kind of... bringing together a miserly manager and a dreadful strike force quite often can lead to not many goals being scored.
It was Moida. Yeah. All right. Sasha, anything else you want to throw into this mix before we...
Last night, the Super Clásico Caliente, as La Nación called it in Buenos Aires.
Oh, yeah.
As Boca won at River, 2-1, two sendings off, a couple of spectacular goals. Guys, check it out on YouTube. And now, you know, we're saying City are 8 points clear now.
Yeah.
In Argentina, Boca Juniors have won 8 games out of 8, scored 21, conceded 2, and they're 9 points clear after 8.
9 points after 8 games.
Running away with it.
That old joke, I wonder how good the seniors must be.
Hey!
Ian?
No, I've got nothing.
Okay, that's it then. We are back on Thursday, unless you're in the Birmingham area, in which case do come and join us at the Glee Club on Wednesday evening. Many, many thanks to you for listening in today. Have yourselves a super couple of days, and we'll see you soon.
The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.